This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today we're firing up the grill and talking summer foods with Bridget Lancaster and Jack Bishop from America's Test Kitchen. They'll offer practical tips for grilling vegetables, meat, and fish, compare gas and charcoal grills, and share favorite recipes for summer soups and salads. Bridget Lancaster specializes in meat dishes. Jack Bishop specializes in vegetable dishes. So whichever you prefer, we've got you covered. Terry Gross spoke to our guests earlier this week.
Bridget Lancaster, Jack Bishop, welcome back to Fresh Air. Since it's summer, I thought that I would ask you each to choose a favorite food to grill. And Bridget, since your specialty is meat, and you say even when you cook a vegetarian dish, there's meat in it, I'm going to ask you to choose a favorite meat to barbecue and tell us how you do it.
That's like picking my favorite child. I'm not sure how to do that. I'd say I have a new favorite these days. One of them is short ribs, which traditionally we haven't grilled short ribs because they have a lot of fat, they have a lot of connective tissue, and they take forever to break down on the grill. But we came up with this method where we start them in the oven and we coat them with the spice rub and steam them with a little bit of vinegar, and it starts to break down the ribs. And then by the time they get to the grill, we baste them with a really kind of a tart mustard and brown sugar sauce. They are amazing. They melt in your mouth. They have this beautiful crust on the outside. I think that might be my new favorite.
So you start in the oven before you actually grill it. Can you explain why? And do you do that with other meats too?
Sure. Well, that's a really effective method for tough cuts of meat, things like a Boston butt, a pork shoulder, giant pork ribs or beef ribs, anything that's really tough on its own. It contains a lot of connective tissue, and it also contains a lot of collagen, and that collagen needs to convert into gelatin. And that's what, if you have pulled pork, that's what gives it that really silky texture. And super moist. So the most effective way, or one of the most effective ways of converting the collagen into gelatin, is a moist, low-heat cooking method. So often we'll start off with these tough cuts and we'll cover them with foil and we'll put them in a relatively low oven for a couple of hours, up to a certain point where they really start to tenderize. And another advantage of that is the fact that you don't have to babysit a grill, so you're not wasting charcoal or propane gas or anything like that. It's all done in the oven. And then just finishing them on the grill with enough smoke to really get some of that flavor in is it's kind of like magic.
To me, definitely. It's almost like you're doubling the work because it's like there's a time in the oven and the time in the grill and the, you know, transition.
Well, think about
between,
yeah. The time in the oven gives you opportunity to maybe work on some of your other dishes too.
And while we're on the subject of meat, what's your favorite kind of hamburger patty for grilling? Like, how do you do that? Since a lot of people are going to be grilling hamburgers.
Right. Well, I am a purist. I like a really good, about 85% lean beef patty. But we've been getting into the habit of grinding our own meat. So that way you can actually choose really flavorful cuts. You can choose short rib meat. You can choose brisket. Trying to think of what are the steak tips. Steak tips are great for grinding up in your food processor. And you can create a beef patty that way. But there's been kind of a schism in the test kitchen, and they've introduced me to turkey burgers, which I have to say I was a really big critic of turkey burgers. I don't know why anyone would ever want to do that. I mean, they're dry. They're like a hockey puck. They don't taste like anything. you know, if you're trying to compare it to a beef burger, it pretty much always loses. But the test kitchen, they're maniacs, and they've actually turned the turkey burger into something that I want to eat. You know, we grind our own turkey, but we use turkey thigh meat instead of the breast meat. So you're already starting off with a much more flavorful cut. And then we're introducing lots of savory flavors. Mushrooms go in there. Soy sauce goes in there. We keep it nice and moist by adding gelatin, actually just plain old gelatin bloomed in a little bit of chicken stock really gives them that silky texture of a beef burger. And then on the other side of it, something that we've been doing quite often now, especially with lean cuts of meat, we soak them or we coat them with a little bit of baking soda. And the baking soda is an alkali. And what that does is it raises the pH level and it tenderizes the meat. So you end up with this turkey burger that is no longer not dry, not tough, inedible, but it's actually succulent, meaty, and juicy.
Oh, that sounds good.
So, yeah.
Okay, on to Jack Bishop. Jack, you're largely into vegetable cooking. Vegetarian. I mean, you're still not quite a vegetarian, right?
I am not a vegetarian, but the nickname in my household that my two teenage daughters have given me is Number One Veg. I'm not sure that's a good thing, but I am the vegetable guy.
Okay. So let's start with something really basic here. How do you cut the vegetables so that they don't fall through the cracks on the grill?
They need to be cut large. And so if you're dealing with something like a zucchini, for instance, cut it lengthwise into planks rather than crosswise into little circles. The worst thing that can happen to your vegetables besides catching on fire and becoming like charcoal is that they fall onto the coals. And so if you cut anything into large, thick pieces, they are going to take longer to cook so that gets more flavor into them, and they're much less likely to fall through the grate onto the coals.
So what are a couple of the vegetables that are your favorites for grilling?
My absolute favorite is red onion. Every time the
grill's
on.
God, I was not expecting that to be the answer.
You were not expecting
no.
that? Did I disappoint you?
No. I'm just surprised.
I love red onions, and every single time I've got my grill on, I am grilling red onions. So I cut the onion into about half-inch thick circles and throw them onto the grill, sort of a medium fire. Don't put them on the hottest part of the grill because they will incinerate, and flip them once. It's a little tricky to flip them. If I'm really being particular, I might skewer the circles of onions so that I can then turn the skewer. But frankly, more often than not, I'm just being careful and turn them once. And I do a couple things with them. One is I'll just serve them as is. I think grilled onions are great as a side dish with almost any of the summer foods. I mean, put them on top of a burger rather than raw onions, or serve them with a steak or chicken. But I will also use them as a component in a lot of summer salads. So if I'm making a summer grain salad, for instance, or a summer pasta salad, I'll then take those grilled onions, chop them up, add them with the grain, add some vinegar, some olive oil, some fresh herbs from my garden, and I've got a really super simple, super flavorful summer salad.
So another favorite vegetable to grill?
I love sweet potatoes on the grill. Mm. I will cut those into, again, about half-inch thick circles, and they need a really, really cool fire, so you can't put them directly over the coals. So if I'm using a gas grill, I'll put them over low or medium-low, and if I'm using charcoal, I'll leave part of the grill empty, and the coals are all banked on half of the grill and the other side is empty. And they'll take about 20 minutes or so, and I just think, again, onions and sweet potato, what happens on the grill is it brings out the natural sugars. And they caramelize, and they just have so much more flavor than any other way that you can cook those vegetables.
So Jack specializes in cooking and writing about vegetables, Bridget in cooking and writing about meat. So who wants to do fish? Who wants to take that?
Fish is the gateway food, right, between the meat and the vegetables?
Because I want to talk about grilling fish.
Oh. Well, let's see what Jack knows about this.
I'm happy to take the fish. The number one complaint that we get from people who watch our TV shows.
Let me guess,
our magazines.
It falls through the cracks of the grate, no?
No, it sticks to the grates.
It solders itself to the grates.
Yeah. Now, the biggest problem is that you can't get the fish off, or what you get off looks like cat food, not like dinner. And so the number one problem that you want to solve is how to deal with your grate. And that, you know, you think about cooking fish indoors, and today, of course, you would cook in a nonstick skillet. I would never cook fish indoors in anything other than nonstick because you have to use so much fat. And even if you use all that fat, it still can stick to a traditional pan. So we've developed a method in the test kitchen to basically turn the cooking grate into a nonstick surface. And what you do is you take a wad of paper towels, dip them in vegetable oil, and then grab the paper towels with some long-handled tongs. And basically, you're rubbing the oil back and forth over the grill grate. And you can actually see the grill grate kind of changes. What's happening is that oil is bonding to the surface of the metal and forming a temporary nonstick surface on your grill grate. Now, you need to rub the oil on at least a half dozen times and really look for the grates to get blacker. And they look like they're nonstick. And then you put the fish down, always putting the fish down diagonal, to the grill grates. That will keep it from falling through the grill grates. It also makes it a little bit easier, I think, to get a spatula underneath when it comes time to flip the fish. So that's the number one thing. And then, you know, with fish is to keep it simple. I mean, you really
don't want to go. I have to stop you and ask you just an obvious question. You're doing this while the grill is hot? You're putting the oil on?
Yes. So you want to preheat the grill like you normally do, you know, 15 minutes, gets really hot. Use your grill brush to get all the gunk off. Despite what your father might have told you, at least my father told me that that was always seasoning the food.
Yeah.
That gunk is just disgusting. You would not cook in a dirty skillet, so why would you cook on a dirty grill?
No, you'd cook in the dirty skillet for the same reason that people always just say the cast iron frying pan with all the gunk on it, it seasons the pot. That's like really good.
Yeah, it's not really good. It's just kind of rancid.
Carbon.
Yeah, it's rancid, gross, or just carbon. And so once you've gotten all the gunk off, then you've got this hot, what it looks like is a very clean surface, and it is clean, but now you need to make that hot grill grate nonstick. And so you're going to be doing that by rubbing the oil-soaked paper towels over the grill grates until they turn a little black. And it really does work. You've got to do it every time you grill. I mean, by the time you're done cooking, the oil has cooked off and your grill grate is back to its regular stick condition rather than nonstick.
So what happens if your fish does fall through the cracks of the openings of the grate? Is there any way of salvaging it, or have you just, you know, made a sacrifice to, like, is it just totally sacrificed?
Do you have a cat? Because that cat's going to eat well. You're pretty much done. At that point, you've sacrificed the fish to the charcoal gods.
So why is food so often much tastier when it's grilled?
Well, I think the grill is an excellent way of really concentrating flavors. You're basically creating this charred surface. I mean, I think some of it is environmental. You're outside. Maybe you have a nice cold beverage in your hand while you're grilling, and kind of the environment sets the pace. But I think the grill does an amazing job of really concentrating flavors, getting that smoky char on the food, which just about makes anything better. Maybe not, you know, pie, but just about everything else makes it so much better.
What's it doing to the food itself?
Well, the number one way food becomes more flavorful through cooking is by getting brown. And that, especially if you're talking about proteins, so meat, fish, chicken, there's an enzymatic reaction called the Maillard reaction, which is the proteins and the natural sugars in the food combining and creating tremendous amounts of flavor compounds. And so you can start out with a raw piece of food that doesn't have a whole lot of flavor, and by browning it, you get a tremendous increase in flavor compounds. Now, of course, you can brown something in a skillet, but it's much trickier in the oven or on the stovetop. You really have to work hard to cook food on a grill and not get it brown. I think you really, it's almost impossible to not get it brown. And so I think that's one of the reasons why the food tastes so much better. You know, I think for a lot of food that's got fat in it, that it gets some of the fat rendered. And rather than sort of sitting in its own fat or sitting in its own juices and steaming, all that drips away, you know, goes down onto the fire. The fire shoots up more heat, which causes more browning, and it just gets that whole process accelerating much faster. And so you get much more browning on a chicken breast or on a piece of fish on the grill than you do in a skillet or in the oven.
So what kind of grills do you prefer? Do you prefer charcoal or gas, or does that depend on where you are?
Well, I'm an equal opportunity griller. I don't really want to choose between both of them. But I use a gas grill probably more often than I do a charcoal grill, and that's because it's super convenient. If I just want to throw a couple burgers on the grill or chicken breast, something quick cooking, vegetables are great. You know, it's kind of a brainless operation. You turn on the heat, you throw them on, done, and then you turn it off. Charcoal is a little bit more of a project. You've got to light the coals and build the fire the right way. But charcoal grills, in my opinion, are – you know, one of the best ways to barbecue or smoke foods. You can get those hardwood chunks or chips, and you put them down in there on top of the coals, and it starts to smoke, and the kettle grill forms this beautiful smoky oven environment for beef or pork or even vegetables if you want to smoke those too. So I think they both have their use.
Jack, what about you?
This is one of those things that Bridget and I are in complete agreement about. At home, I have both a gas grill and a charcoal grill. And as Bridget said, when I want smoke flavor, I will go through the extra work of using a charcoal grill and adding wood chunks and get that smoke flavor. If I'm just really grilling some vegetables, I grill everything. I mean, I grill bread in the summer, and I'm not going to build a charcoal fire to grill four slices of bruschetta, for instance. But I will be totally happy to turn the gas grill on to grill four slices of bread.
How often do you clean your grills, and how do you clean them?
Are you talking about the grate surface?
The grates
I clean before every time I use them. Mm-hmm. So I heat up the grill, both with charcoal or gas, heat it up and get it really super hot because the food is released much easier if the grates are hot. And then you just scrape it with a grill brush. And then, as Jack mentioned, you want to go back over it and season the grill with the oil and the paper towel method. But it's really best to scrape that grill grate every single time.
Yeah, and there's some longer-term maintenance that you probably want to do on occasion. Most gas grills have a drip tray underneath, and fat will collect down there. And once every couple of months, you want to take that drip tray out, clean it out. I learned this the hard way. When I first started using a gas grill, I didn't realize that that drip tray had to be emptied. And at some point, there was so much fat in there that it caught on fire. And it was not good. The neighbors came running because then the grill caught on fire. So you really do want to empty that drip tray every couple of months. I think it had been a couple of years when this fire happened. So I learned the hard way. And when you're dealing with a charcoal grill, you want to get rid of those spent coals. That if you grilled on a Tuesday night and you come back on Friday night and there's sort of some charcoal down in there, just clean it out, because what it's going to do is clog up the air vents and prevent that next fire from really catching properly. So if there's a lot of charcoal, it's just a little dust, that's fine. But if there are a lot of sort of half-charred coals down there, you really want to get rid of them before you build the next fire.
Let's move on to salads for the summer. Bridget, do you want to share with us one of your favorite easy summer salad recipes?
I recently came across – I'm usually a big bean salad person. I love bean salad. So you have the different kinds of beans in there. You have a nice vinaigrette. And I tend to go with the vinaigrette-based salads more than the creamy salads. But we just recently did this lentil salad, and it's kind of a – game changer for me. The lentils are brined for about 30 minutes, and the brine softens the outside of the lentil, keeps the interior of the lentil nice and creamy. So you end up with lentils that don't get burst open and mushy and hard. And then after cooking them with some chicken stock, then you drain them and toss them with a vinaigrette and lots of mint or feta, nice summery flavors. It's beautiful.
Jack, you have a really tasty-sounding potato salad with Indian-flavored potatoes and chickpeas for protein. Would you describe your recipe?
Sure. You know, I like heartier vegetable salads in the summer, and I don't really, you know, Bridget's going to laugh, I don't like your classic mayonnaise-based American salad. It's a bit of a joke around the office. It's like, don't bring me anything that has too much mayonnaise in it.
It's the egg thing.
Yeah, it's the egg thing.
The egg thing?
I don't really like eggs. I know I shouldn't really say that because, you know, my life is food, and I basically eat pretty much anything except for undercooked eggs. And mayonnaise falls into the undercooked egg category as far as I'm concerned. But back to the recipe that we talked about. So I like potatoes because they're a great vessel for soaking up flavors, and love to go with more intense flavors. And Indian food is perfect. You know, I'm not sure they do room temperature in potato salads in India, but using mustard seeds, using those big flavors, you can use the ground spices, cumin, coriander, certainly have some garlic and some onions in there. Sometimes I'll add greens to it. So in addition to the chickpeas, I will at the last minute, when the potatoes have been cooked and drained and are still just a little bit warm, add some arugula, add some watercress, some spinach. It'll wilt a little bit. If you don't like the greens, you can leave them out. And what you're really trying to do is the most important thing, even if you're making a classic mayonnaise-based potato salad, is to season the potatoes while they're warm with, if you're using vinegar, spices, garlic, get all that stuff in. And then if you're making a classic American-style potato salad, add the mayonnaise once it's cooled. But when those potatoes are still warm, they will soak up all of those flavors so much better. So whatever it is that you're dressing your salad with, do it while the potatoes are warm.
So, Bridget, do you have a suggestion for a good cold summer soup?
A good cold summer soup? Anything but beet. Like Jack to eggs,
you don't
beets,
like
are
borscht?
My, no? Beets are my kryptonite, I have to say. I become weak when I'm around them. We did a really nice chilled tomato soup recently. It's beautiful. It's nice. It's cold. You get to use those tomatoes from the garden. They get roasted just briefly, again, to concentrate their flavors. But speaking of mayonnaise, we put them in the food processor, and then we drizzle a little bit of oil into the soup, and it creates an emulsion like a mayonnaise. So you end up with this really luxurious, silky, rich tomato soup, and it's beautiful. Lovely with a nice bread.
Jack, do you have a favorite cold summer soup?
I love cucumber avocado, and the best part about a cucumber avocado soup is that you don't even need to turn on the oven or use the stove. You're really just having the cucumbers lengthwise, getting rid of the seeds. In this case, cucumber seeds, unlike tomato seeds, have no real flavor, and they are just going to detract from the texture. And throwing those seeded cucumbers in the blender with some avocado, which will add body. And then that's really kind of a canvas. And you can add herbs. You can add garlic. You can add a little bit of yogurt to it if you want to make it a little creamier. You could go a Mexican route with something like that and add cilantro and chilies. You could go sort of more refined French route and add, you know, tarragon to it.
And that'd be
nice. Yeah, it's a nice, simple, it seems like it shouldn't be soup. And if your cucumbers are cold, I mean, avocados really belong on the counter, so they're not going to be cold. But if the cucumbers are cold, it's a soup that will chill in 20 minutes in the refrigerator afterwards. And it's kind of like an emergency summer soup when you haven't planned ahead.
Jack Bishop and Bridget Lancaster are from the PBS show America's Test Kitchen. You'll find a longer version of their conversation with Terry that includes recipes for summer desserts on our website, freshair.npr.org. In recent years, Oliver Stone has made fewer violent thrillers and more dramas, like the George W. Bush biopic W, the survival story World Trade Center, and the sequel to his 1987 film Wall Street. But his latest film is a return to action and gunplay. Savages stars Taylor Kitsch and Aaron Johnson as pot growers, with a cast that includes John Travolta, Benicio del Toro, and Blake Lively. Critic David Edelstein has this review.
Often I'm asked, what's the worst movie ever made? And I say, I don't know. But my own least favorite is Oliver Stone's Natural Born Killers. The early script by Quentin Tarantino was heavily revised, and the final film became a celebration of serial killers, now existential heroes with absolute freedom. Beyond the bombardment that was Stone's direction, the worldview was abominable. The thriller Savages is in the same brutal, druggy realm of Natural Born Killers. But Stone has evolved in the last decade and a half, and the new film has a deeper, more complicated perspective. The violence isn't a kick. It's horrifying, senseless. Amid the mayhem, you think, it didn't have to go down this way. Why does it? Business. That was the point of Stone's last film, Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps, that business could ravage anything, even family. The family in Savages is surrogate, but ideal. It's a menage a trois, two buddies, Chan and Ben, and their rich California girlfriend, O, short for Ophelia, who narrates. Their business is growing marijuana, innovative strains, using part of their profits to build villages in Africa. Aaron Johnson's Ben is the idealist. Taylor Kitsch's Chon, that's C-H-O-N, the angry, haunted Iraq war vet. The men are opposites, loved equally by Blake Lively's O, because together, she tells us, they form the perfect whole. It's a remarkably gentle arrangement, until harsh reality intrudes in the form of a video email sent from the Baja cartel, in which a man in a skull mask displays 7 severed human heads. The Mexicans demand a share of Chon and Ben's business in return for giving them wider distribution. And the corrupt local DEA agent, Dennis, played by John Travolta, thinks their course of action should be a no-brainer.
Welcome to the recession, boys. You should be grateful you still have a product people want.
So you don't mind if your envelope gets a little thinner then?
you guys, you know, you have a clean business, there's no problems, but there ain't no Ben and Chon without Dennis. So my envelope stays the same. Just a matter of time, guys, before they legalized it. I mean, I'd take the deal instead of decapitation.
Pot-bellied with thinning hair, Travolta gives his best performance in ages as a man who's thoroughly amoral, but not inhuman. He's a realist, and the reality, he thinks, is that the war on drugs is insane and breeds more insanity. He rationalizes taking a piece of everything because he has kids to support and a terminally ill wife. Every character talks about his or her family, even the scariest, the Mexican assassin Lado, played with demonic gravity by Benicio del Toro, his face all black hollows. Lado's boss, Elena, is played with relish by Salma Hayek in a jet-black Prince Valiant wig. Elena took over the cartel after the deaths of her husband and sons and says of her daughter, the only family left, "She's ashamed of me, and I'm proud of her for it." To get Chon and Ben to cooperate, she has Lado steal what they love best, O, a kidnap victim just mouthy and entitled enough to appeal to Elena's motherly instincts.
I like talking to you again. But let me remind you that if I had to, I wouldn't have a problem cutting both their throats.
Well, you'll never get them together. I'm the only one who can do that.
Come on. Are you really bragging about that? There's something wrong with your love story, baby. They may love you, but they will never love you as much as they love each other. Otherwise, they wouldn't share you, would they?
Are Ben and Chon more in love with each other? It's not clear, since they pull out all the stops to get O back. Even Ben the humanitarian will do anything, no matter how ghastly, for the sake of his family. Savages is based on a book by Don Winslow that reads like notes for the screenplay he co-wrote with Shane Salerno and Stone. The narrative gets looser as the movie goes on, the characters' mixed up emotions forcing the melodrama off its tracks. But the melodrama comes back with a vengeance, an infernal machine that can't be turned off. Stone, the cackling nihilist of natural-born killers, is now Stone, the tragic romantic.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed the new Oliver Stone film, Savages. Coming up, we'll meet Chef Marcus Samuelson. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. My guest Marcus Samuelson's new memoir is in part about what it takes to be a master chef, the insults and abuse suffered in training, and the demands of running a business. And it's in part the story of his remarkable life. He was born in Ethiopia, raised in Sweden, trained in some of Europe's finest restaurants, and is now a resident of Harlem and owner of one of New York's most celebrated restaurants, Red Rooster at 125th Street and Lenox Avenue. Along the way, Samuelson cooked on a cruise ship, became the youngest chef ever to get a 3-star review in the New York Times, and took first place on Bravo TV's Top Chef Masters competition. He's written several cookbooks. His memoir is called Yes, Chef. Well, Marcus Samuelson, welcome to Fresh Air. Do you remember when you first became fascinated with food?
Absolutely. Food has always been in my life, and I think it's on two aspects. Being born in Ethiopia and when there was lack of food, and then really cooking with my grandmother Helga. And my grandmother Helga in Sweden, she was a cook's cook. She always cooked. When you came to her kitchen, when you came to her home, the first thing you remember is the smells. It just smelled of food. And you were you had to be ready to work when you got to her house. You know, we were jarring, we were pickling, there was always a bowl of chicken soup or something ready to be served, or there was always sausage ready to be made. And she was in season all year round with cooking. And it's really when I came up to her house and started to spend the afternoons there after school and just learning how to make meatballs, or learning how to make ginger snap cookies, or learning how to make fresh breadcrumbs from a day-old bread. And so it's really in those rituals that my love for food was really built. It wasn't just about serving the meal. It was really about picking the carrots, getting the apples. It was going to the butcher, going to the fishmonger, and being part of the whole experience of cooking. And dining is just eating at the table. Dinner at the table was just one aspect. You know, cleaning up was also a ritual that we had to do. You know, learning how to eat properly with a fork and knife, where your elbows should be on the table. It was really the energy of our family was centered around eating. It was the time where we knew when our father got promoted or my sister or I did well in school.
So you worked at a restaurant, you went to a cooking school in Sweden, then you went to one of the better restaurants in the country, then you went to Interlaken, Switzerland, and from there,
yes,
other places. Now, you also did a couple of tours on a cruise ship, cooking on a cruise,
yes,
ship. Now, that's, I think, a very different kind of experience. What did you get out of that?
Well, working on a cruise ship, I got many things. You know, I saw the world for the first time. I always wanted to see the world. I learned how to eat really good Filipino food because the Filipino crew cooked incredible food at the crew mess every day. But I also realized for the first time that all the great food was not owned by Europe. There were places like Singapore. There were places like Acapulco. Wonderful places in you know, South America. And this sort of, that yes, the food that I'm so passionate about could come from Europe, specifically from France, but it could also come from a wonderful sort of taqueria or fonda in Mexico that didn't exist. Of course, it existed for generation, but not in our vocabulary as chefs.
So
that was so important to me, that street food could be just as yummy and delicious as the highest art of French cooking.
So you were learning your lessons about tastes and flavors, not from what you were making for the guests on the cruise,
absolutely,
but what you were getting going ashore at street stands.
Absolutely. And I learned incredible, again, work ethic. On the cruise ship, we worked breakfast, lunch, and dinner 7 days a week for 5 months, right? So then you do that, breakfast, lunch, and dinner 7 days a week. You know, you become... Your skills get honed every day. You train, and it's very tough. It's very, very tough.
Now, when you got to the United States, you came to New York at one point and started at this restaurant, Aquavit. You want to tell us a little bit about that place?
I got to New York and Aquavit, and Aquavit at this time was very well known in Sweden. It was a big deal for us as Swedes to have a restaurant in New York City. So
it focused on Swedish food, right?
Yeah, it focuses on Scandinavian food, and it was my former partner Håkan Swan that I wrote to, and he gave me a chance to come to New York. And this was such an amazing time. It was just also the development, really, what I think of these New York chefs, like, you know, Jean-Georges was very young, Daniel, Alfred Portal, Bobby Flay was just coming up. So the city was just bustling with these young chefs, American chefs also, and French chefs, sort of figuring out what should the New York food scene look like. So to be there in the middle of all that, watching this sort of in front of me, but also being eventually becoming part of that, it's an amazing journey. You know, the fact that we got 3 stars after I became a chef was obviously a big deal. I became the executive chef because the chef before me, Jan Sendel, passed away.
Right. That was quite a remarkable story. You, were at the age of 24, became the executive chef of this really quite well-regarded restaurant. And that was a huge thing for you to get a 3-star review from the New York Times. At this point, you had begun to develop some of your own innovative stuff. What were some things you were cooking there that was...
It was always for me about keep asking myself questions. Will I be this young cook that would just taking these French dishes and doing it? And I was like, no. I refuse that. I have to have authorship in my food. I have to figure out what is me, what is my story, what is my take on this. And I started to build up this Scandinavian building block where we're really pickling and preserving, this sort of, it has to be a strong narrative of seafood in there. Game was very, very important because that's what we grew up with, a lot of game meat. So game meat, pickling and preserving, and this sort of balance between sweet and sour and seafood became sort of pillars that I hung up every dish on. So a dish could be like salt-cured and duck with potato pancake and lingonberry ginger vinaigrette. That would have been a duck dish that would have been an appetizer back then. I salt-cured it the way my grandmother taught me. I seared it the way I was taught in France. The lingonberry jam I knew how to do, but I added in more ginger the way I maybe experienced it in Asia. And the potato cake was rushed it the way I've seen them similar in Switzerland.
The other thing you write about is how you spent all of this time going through Chinatown and other parts of New York picking up new flavors. I mean, you also went to Ethiopia and became reacquainted with the land of your birth and got Ethiopian dishes and spices. I mean, that's a lot of stuff to bring together, isn't it?
Well, first of all, I fell in love with Aquavit, but also fell in love with New York and all of New York, that other New York, Queens, Brooklyn, and Chinatown. And Chinatown spoke to me so well because it's something that I've experienced in other places on the boat. But to have one place to go down to and constantly being put in front of ingredients that I wasn't familiar with, that was my way of, being curious and saying, wow, what happens if I take jackfruit and put it on a sorbet? Sometimes some good, sometimes not so good. What is galanga? Because I've had this flavor before. Kefir lime leaf in a sorbet, and so on. So the narrative of non-European food spoke to me, probably because I came from Africa, but I didn't know where to get it from. And Asia then became the Asian and the Chinese culture, and going to K-Town, Korean Town on 32nd Street, became these places for me where I could just, buy a bunch of ingredients, try them out in my kitchen at Aquavit, and eventually put them on the menu. And it's almost a laboratory, it became a lab, and, it was driven with a lot of love and passion. Getting to Ethiopia was much later, and I felt there was time for me to start, when in New York, when an Ethiopian person responded to me right away, I didn't know that first of all. Why are they talking to me? I felt like, I'm Swedish. But of course, for any person in New York City, when they look at me, they see I'm an Ethiopian man. So it took me a while. So I really learned about Ethiopia from the Ethiopian community here in New York. And then eventually I warmed up to the idea of, I have to learn more about myself.
We're speaking with Marcus Samuelson. His new book about his career as a chef is called Yes, Chef. I have to ask you about the honor of being chosen to cook for President Obama's first state dinner. You want to talk a little bit about developing that menu?
Well, that was such a huge honor. First time when Sam Cass called me, he's a chef down in D.C. working with the Obamas, I felt like, is somebody pulling a joke on me here? Are you kidding me? And he was so cautious, Chef Katz, because he's like, you're in the running. You know, he didn't want to give it in any way, you know, give any false hope, you know, because he can't. Because at any given time, it could be somebody else. So I remember that first development menu that we made. I just started to ask myself questions, you know. It's for the Indian Prime Minister. I also watch, you know, the evolution of Michelle Obama's wonderful initiative with a garden. So I started to think about the food, not necessarily it's like what will be the best food that I cook, but actually from a serving point of view, wouldn't it be better if it would be something that speaks towards India, something to speak towards her commitment to the garden? Wouldn't it be better to do something to highlight America and American wines? Because I looked a little bit at the former state dinners, and they were all French food. Whether they, you know, and that I think makes sense if it's a French prime minister coming, but not necessarily if it's the Indian prime minister. So our state dinner was historical in many ways. It was Obama's first, but it was also the first time where we really didn't serve French food at the state dinner.
So what was your menu? What did you serve?
Well, the menu, you know, for me it was important also to sort of bring it to this sense of it's a dinner party, right? So we started, what could be better at a dinner party than breaking bread? So I started with a bread course, which was sort of the first time there. So I had both cornbread and Indian chapatis that you can sort of dip in sambals and chutneys. And I thought it would envision this way of these people maybe not knowing each other on the table, but sort of passing this sense of, hey, let's break bread. So we started with a bread course. Then we had a salad course where the salad was actually picked from the First Lady's garden. And then we did a lentil soup. I wanted to make this commitment to humble ingredients that would taste just delicious because they were cooked and prepared with spice in a certain way. So I had a red lentil soup. And then we had a vegetarian course, which was pumpkin dumplings with a little bit of tomato jam and greens, or green prawns that were really taken from New Orleans, was taken from Louisiana. So we did this sort of beautiful shrimp dish with the curry spices, and then we did a pumpkin tart for dessert with a little bit of Indian garam masala spices, all served with American wines.
We have just a bit of time left, and I do want to ask you about the Red Rooster, the restaurant
yes.
that you've opened in Harlem. First of all, why Harlem?
Well, after 9/11 and the economical downturn, I started to ask myself questions. Marcus, you have to have a deeper interaction with the city. You know, I was living in Midtown, and I felt like, you know what? If you can connect this city, if you can really change the footprint of dining, you know, it's really about putting a restaurant in Harlem. And I couldn't go half in. So I moved from Midtown to Harlem. But I didn't dare to open the restaurant for another 3 years, 3-4 years, because I felt like I didn't know Harlem well enough. Just because I'm black doesn't mean that I would know Harlem. So I felt like I have to sort of bike it, walk it, and learn it, and understand these sort of words that are thrown out so strongly, like whether it's a food desert, and you know, even as strong as food apartheid you hear sometimes, and so on. And I feel like, no, this is not a desert, and it's absolutely not apartheid. For me, it was more about food chasm. And that's really what I landed on. This is food chasm. We have food. And I felt like, you know what? I got to put a restaurant in the middle of that community. And what if we can change the footprint of dining?
And you say a food chasm, meaning?
Well, for me, I feel food chasm hits it because we have food. It's just about the options in neighborhoods like Harlem. The good food options are lesser than there are north, south of 96th Street. And I resent that. I said, why should my options of food options be lower because I crossed 96th Street? That's unacceptable. You know, we have better options today than we had in the 50s. And we have to have better options today in terms of food. You know, it's not about saying, hey, you're not allowed to have sodas, or you're not allowed to have any fast food. It's okay to have those. But it has to be more options as well. You know, when you walk into a store in certain parts of Harlem, and they never have corn in corn season, and they never have apples in apple season. That cannot be 2012. That's unacceptable. You know, Ethiopia has more fresher food options than inner city of America, and I just feel like we have failed there. And the opportunity to start really narrow and bridge that was to be in Harlem, happy in and of Harlem, inspire other people to do the same. Because once you come up and see a restaurant, what happens? You just don't come up and eat. You really come and see the neighborhood. You see the people of that neighborhood. And you say, you know what? I'm going to go back and go here for a museum. Or I'm going to go and see, listen to something at the Apollo. And you start looking at people, not just from, oh, yeah, I've been to Harlem, and which was really, I was driving in there, taking a picture and then leaving. No, it's about this journey of normalcy, of normal behavior in the community, and react and deal in a way that you would do in any other part of town.
Now, one of the interesting things when you look at the menu, you see some Swedish dishes and you see some mm-hmm. Ethiopian food and, of course, some very traditional kind of soul food things. And I'm wondering yes. when you take something like fried chicken, you give it an original take. And that must be tricky because people are, you know, it's a food that people have a great love for in a traditional way. You want to talk about what is your fried chicken? What do you do?
No, fried chicken was obviously one of the things that you're going to open a restaurant in Harlem. There's about 500,000 people in Harlem. I knew there was about 250,000 fried chicken experts. And I wanted to, but I wanted to, again, have some authorship in mind, right? So I ate a lot of fried chicken. I started to go to a place called Charles in Harlem to try the original great fried chicken. And then I said, okay, what's our take on this? What's going to be my take on this? And how are we going to develop it so it's better, but yet there's some familiarity? And I looked at fried chicken like a great foie gras from France. How do you have authorship on this? And I started to make some decisions right away. I want to cure it the way my grandmother cured it, in lemon and salt. I'm going to marinate it with a little bit of African influence, like coconut milk and buttermilk. And then the chef and me started to think about it. I got to fry it on both low and high heat. That's how you get it cooked through and crispy. Now, the flour can be classic flour with a little bit of a hint of corn in there. But most of, more than anything, spices. So next to the fried chicken, I had to create a spice blend. So we call it the chicken shake. The chicken shake has my spice blend and has lots of berberi from Ethiopia. And all of these different steps, cooking it on low heat to high heat, giving it the chicken shake on top of it, marinating both in buttermilk and coconut milk, letting it sit in the water and the lemon the way my grandmother did, all of that gives us the authorship and the license to call it the Red Rooster Fried Chicken. Specific ways and decisions that we had to take. You know, then otherwise we were not chefs. You have to have a point of view. You have to have a take on a dish like fried chicken.
Marcus Samuelson. His new memoir is called Yes, Chef. You'll find a much longer version of our conversation online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Fred Snyder. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.